This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Tom Matte, now 77 years old, is modest when he recalls his 12-year NFL career.
I was sort of the jack of all trades and master of none, and I wasn't the superstar by no means.
Actually, once upon a time, he sort of was, and I'll explain. I was reminded of some of Tom Matte's sort of superstar days with the old Baltimore Colts this week because of what's been happening to a contemporary NFL team. The New England Patriots, without their first-string quarterback due to suspension, have used two backups at that position. Injuries to both of them led to 2 weeks of speculation about whether a guy who'd never played the position in the pros might have to do so. Which brings us back to Tom Matte. Under normal circumstances during the 1965 season, Matte's job was to run the ball and catch the occasional pass from Hall of Fame quarterback Johnny Unitas.
He had confidence in me. I had good hands. I could catch the football. And after I caught the football, I could get some extra yards. And that's what he wanted. Because you didn't want to come back in that huddle if you dropped a pass. I'd come back in the huddle and John say, "Tom, you want to play quarterback today?" I says, "No, John." He says, "Then catch the football."
Matte and his teammates usually did what was expected of them. The Colts made it to the championship game in 1964. They expected no less in 65. But in the third-to-last regular season game, Unitas, the previous year's MVP, went down with an injury. That meant that backup quarterback Gary Quazzo would be in charge the rest of the way, unless he were to go the way of Johnny Unitas.
They said, "You better take some snaps from center." And I says, "Why?" And he says, "Well, if Quazzo gets hurt, we're going to have to put you in at quarterback." And I says, "You got to be kidding me."
It wasn't the first time Tom Matte had been asked to play quarterback. At Ohio State, Coach Woody Hayes had decided that his running back might be more useful under center. The running back didn't agree.
I said, "I don't want to play quarterback." I said, "I don't want to have anything to do with it. I have a small hands, and throwing a spiral was hard enough for me to do it." He says, "Well, we don't like to throw the ball anyway, so we always had that theme of 3 yards and a cloud of dust." And but somehow, I ended up as an All-American quarterback, and then I get drafted by the Baltimore Colts in the first round in 1961, and I'm saying, "What do they want me for? They got John Unitas here? You're drafting me as a quarterback?" I couldn't believe it. Well, I found out quickly that they weren't drafting me as a quarterback. They were switching me back to running back.
Tom Matte hoped that switch would stick. So when Quazzo took over for Unitas, Matte's advice for the backup sounded pretty familiar.
I said, "Don't get hurt. I don't want to play quarterback."
So, of course, Quazzo got hurt almost immediately. The trainer was able to keep Quazzo's injured shoulder numb for the length of that game. The following week, Tom Matte trotted onto the field to face the Los Angeles Rams at a position he hadn't played in almost 5 years.
I'm saying, "Oh, my God, don't tell me I have to play quarterback." And I get in a huddle, and the whole offensive line sort of looks at me and says, "Good luck, Matte."
Matte had a couple of coaches who designed a game plan based on what he could do. He handed off a lot. He ran a lot. And because he was no Johnny Unitas, he didn't pass much. And his coaches also came up with an innovation to help him remember the plays.
And Don McCafferty says, "Hey," and Shula said this, he says, "Hey, listen, why don't you put a wristband in? We'll signal to you which play we want you to call and all this kind of stuff." So I said, "Okay." And it was like a wristband with a little plastic cover in it, so if it got wet, nothing would happen. And I had all the plays written on it, and who wrote the plays on it but my wife? She could print smaller than I could, so we had it all printed out.
And the Colts beat the Rams 20-17. The following week, with Unitas and Quazzo still prepared to do nothing but watch and offer advice, Tom Matte, 1-0 as a pro quarterback, took the field against the Green Bay Packers. These days, Tom Matte recalls his career as great fun. But the pressure before and during that game against Green Bay must have been considerable. Winning meant the Colts would return to the NFL championship game. Losing meant they'd play in the game the players called the Toilet Bowl, a consolation tilt to determine third place. The Colts lost on a disputed Green Bay field goal about which, to this day, Tom Matte says there shouldn't have been a dispute. The kick was wide. Anyway, that meant he and his teammates would face the Dallas Cowboys for the championship of nothing, which is perhaps why Colts coach Don Shula was willing to turn Tom Matte loose.
Shula called the whole defense into the shower room. Now, listen to this story. This is really funny. He called the defense into the shower room for a private meeting. He says, well, first of all, he says, I'm going to let Maddie throw the football, and I don't know what the hell's going to happen. You guys may have to play a lot today.
The defense plays a lot more than they like to play, when their team's quarterback throws interceptions. Shula was trying to prepare them for that possibility. Tom Maddie, like his coach, had very little idea of how switching up the game plan would work out.
I was praying they were going to catch the ball, because half the time they were like knuckleballs instead of spirals. But they did catch the ball.
Two of those catches were for touchdowns. Maddie and his teammates must have done some serious running as well. The Colts beat the Cowboys 35-3.
And we just kicked their butts all over the field. We were laughing after it, and everybody had a great time.
Maddie was named the game's MVP. He's got the game ball in his trophy room, along with one of the wristbands he wore that season.
In fact, somebody gave me a wooden carving of a hand and a wrist, and so I have that wrapped around there, and it's it's sitting in the den. All these guys today, if you take a look, all of them are wearing wristbands. I should have patented the damn thing.
Wristbands, game plans, and a protective offensive line all worked for Tom Maddie 50 years ago. He won't speculate on how well another emergency quarterback might fare these days, though he does have some advice for a running back or receiver pressed into that kind of service.
Just don't make any major mistakes.
Good advice under any circumstances. Great advice if you're playing football's most important position in a game that counts. To read more about Tom Maddie and other non-quarterback quarterbacks, check out Sports Illustrated's story, Emergency NFL QBs Who've Been Called Into Action. You can find a link at onlyagame.org. Tim Kirkjian is one of the country's most experienced and respected baseball writers, but long before he joined ESPN, back when he was following the Baltimore Orioles for the Washington Star, Tim broke one of the game's unwritten rules.
I rode on the Orioles team bus in 1980 once, and I just sat in the first seat was available, which was Earl Weaver, the manager's seat on the bus. And I had one of my veteran writers say, Tim, you're not sitting there. Nobody sits there except for the manager.
Tim didn't know he'd broken one of baseball's unwritten rules. How could he have known the rule was unwritten? There's considerable disagreement about the particulars of some of those rules, but players learn early that it's bad form to bunt in an attempt to break up a no-hitter. Lots of pitchers regard the mound as territory that belongs exclusively to them, so woe to the hitter who gets thrown out at first and runs across the pitcher's mound on his way back to the third base dugout. Tim Kirkjian says nobody knows when the first of baseball's unwritten rules was invoked, or who did it, or even really what it was. But over time, one general principle has emerged at the center of the mysterious particulars. That principle gets passed down from veterans to rookies, whether the veterans and rookies are players or sports writers, and it goes something like this.
Well, if you as a player do anything to disrespect another player or another team or the game, you are going to pay for it one way or another.
Really? Does that mean an opposing player who feels he's been disrespected might poison the disrespecter's Wheaties or scratch the guy's name off the lineup card? The answer, according to Tim Kirkjian, is no. The consequence of breaking an unwritten rule is simpler than that and less sneaky and more painful. He illustrates his point with a story.
So many years ago, Ed Farmer was a relief pitcher, and Wayne Gross was a pedestrian hitter, and Gross hit a home run off of Ed Farmer, and he took his sweet time running around the bases, and Ed Farmer was just furious at Wayne Gross, so he vowed, I'm going to get back at that guy, but the problem is, being a reliever and the other guy being just an ordinary player, he didn't face him again for 3 years, and at that time, 3 years later, he was his teammate. So in the first batting practice of spring training 1 year, Ed Farmer hit Wayne Gross right in the back with a 90-mile-an-hour fastball during batting practice as teammates. So Wayne Gross looks at Ed Farmer and screams at him, what was that for? And Ed Farmer said, that was for 3 years ago. And Wayne Gross said, okay, we're even now.
The unwritten rule rules. And according to Tim, who's collected stories about this phenomenon, 3 years, that ain't nothing.
Stan Williams was a pitcher in the big leagues and a pretty good one for a long time. And he used to carry a list of names in his cap during games. Someone asked him once, what are those names for? And he goes, oh, those are the guys I have to get. And they said, well, why do you keep them in your cap? And he said, so I don't ever forget any of them. And the same Stan Williams, I just recently learned, actually hit a guy on purpose in an old-timers game because he never had a chance to get him during their regular season career. Only in baseball, Bill.
Maybe so, but even in baseball, times change, or at least technology does. The bats are still made of wood, of course, and the ball will always be hard enough so that when you get hit with a pitch, it'll hurt. But today's major leaguers have at their fingertips tools to express their disrespect that Tim Kirkjian couldn't have imagined back in 1980 when he sat in Earl Weaver's seat on that bus.
Adam Dunn, who used to play in the major leagues, told me that someday somebody is going to take out his cell phone out of his pocket and he is going to text somebody as he's running around the bases on a home run and say, hey, I'm running around the bases right now. I just went deep in a major league game. Adam Dunn said, I just hope I'm not even alive when that happens because I won't be able to take anything like that.
I'm with Adam Dunn on that one, though the transgression would seem to call for a response more creative than plunking the cell phone guy the next time he came to the plate, wouldn't it? Wouldn't the more creative pitcher sabotage the batter's fantasy team by stealing his password and dropping all the good players? Or maybe by texting the hitter's credit card number to everybody on the team and inviting them to go shopping. Nah, Tim's probably got it right. Next time that hitter came up, the pitcher would probably hit him right in the pocket where he kept that cell phone. There's lots more to come on Only a Game, but while you're thinking about it, consider leaving us a review on iTunes or Stitcher. It helps other listeners find our podcast, and we always like to hear your thoughts on our show. I'm Bill Littlefield. This week's Three Stories You Should Know begins with an acknowledgement of loss. Miami Marlins pitcher Jose Fernandez died Sunday in a boating accident. He was only 24 years old. Also on Sunday, golf legend Arnold Palmer passed away. He was 87. Joining me are Will Leach of Sports on Earth and Rachel Bachman of the Wall Street Journal. Welcome back to both of you.
Great to be here, Bill.
Thanks for having me.
Will, why don't you start us off this time?
You know, I'm a professional journalist that writes about a lot of things. And one of the things that people expect you to do, particularly when something as tragic as Jose Fernandez or the death of Arnold Palmer happens, is they expect you to write an obit. And I discovered as I sat down that I just couldn't do it. When we look at someone like Jose Fernandez, what he stood for me, and I think for a lot of baseball fans, was not only this otherworldly talent, but this joy of performance and how exciting that was and how it was moving the game and then new direction. So I sat down to write that, and then I suddenly felt incredibly cheap, like, oh, this is this guy that represents this thing in baseball that's very important to me. But that's just a public persona that I'm seeing. Writing an obit feels like walking into a room that I wasn't invited to sometimes. And I felt that a little bit, particularly with the death of Jose Fernandez.
I think, Will, what you wrote about reminded me of something that made me very uncomfortable, and that is these moments when sports writers are called upon to make these, you know, quite sweeping judgments that we're really not equipped to make. And the example I use is the redemption story. You know, a guy's been through rehab or some trauma or maybe is coming back after committing a crime, and there is sort of a temptation to write that he's a changed man and so on. But, of course, we don't really know that. We don't know these guys, really. At the end of the day, we really don't know exactly who they are in their deepest, darkest moments.
Some of the people about whom I write, I know them well as friends, but it's a small number. And writers and fans, as you suggest, really don't know most of the athletes. And it's important to be reminded of that context and perspective and of the complexity of what it's like to be alive on the planet. And I think you did that very, very well.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad I wrote that in 7-0-bit that I would have very much struggled with. So, yes.
I learned a new word this week, and it's spatting. And it means covering up or painting out the corporate logo on a pair of shoes or a wristband or shirt, whatever. You put a piece of tape over the Nike swoosh, and you have engaged in spatting. And maybe both of you already knew this. I learned the word by reading a piece by William Wilson in Vice Sports. And he has suggested that spatting, or even merely threatening to spat, would be a great way for college athletes to get a better deal from the universities where they play football or basketball. So here's an example. Nike pays the University of Texas so the athletes there wear Nike shoes. And in their contract, Nike has a clause that says they can get a refund of up to $100,000 if the logos on five individual shoes are spatted. The word's not actually in the contract, but the meaning is clear. A bench player who tried this would probably lose his scholarship and his place on the team. But if a number of prominent players, really, you know, guys who were critical to the team, did it, wouldn't the universities and colleges pretty quickly decide to offer better medical coverage and vouchers so the athletes could keep on as students after they were no longer eligible to be athletes or whatever else? Rachel, what do you think? Is this likely to happen soon?
I don't know whether it's likely to happen soon, but I think it's sort of a genius idea. You know, there have been for decades athletes who have been outspoken. When I was covering Oregon State football in the late 90s, early 2000s, there was a very outspoken running back named Ken Simonton, who obviously made administrators very uncomfortable with some of the things he said about exploitation of players and so on. They couldn't bench him. He was too good. He was their starting running back. He had 30, 35 carries a game. And that is what it takes. I think if they were to do that, the response could be fairly immediate.
When the Missouri football team said that they weren't going to play unless something was involved with the president of the school, the president resigned. Athletes were almost collectively were like a dog that didn't realize their bark was as loud as it was. The idea that this would immediately, however, go to, okay, well, this will get them better benefits and this will get them better coverage, that is something that the NCAA has been so reluctant to crack the door open for. There would be a debate about it and there would be a discussion, but it feels like something that, frankly, coaches would be have to answer for as much as players would, because really a lot of this money is going to coaches.
I don't know. I just thought it was a great idea, and I hope to see it happen at some point. And even if it doesn't, I'm always excited to learn a new word. Rachel, I gather you've been keeping tabs on aspiring ninjas, so have at it.
Yes, well, anyone who is familiar with TV or YouTube has probably heard of the NBC show American Ninja Warrior, wherein people race through these elaborate obstacle courses with feats of gymnastic daring do. The group that perhaps most enthusiastically follows this show is kids who aren't even eligible to compete. But as one guy I talked to said, these courses are sort of like the world's biggest floor is lava game. And I think that's one of the things that kids love about it. You know, as these gym owners who are opening up these ninja gyms all over the country are finding, you know, their best customers are children. So I'm curious to hear what you guys think.
Well, I can say I have two small boys and my house is an unofficial version of American Ninja Warrior, mm-hmm. pretty much 24 hours of the day. This is something that is immediately enticing to children. I live in Athens, Georgia, and it's surprising to me the number of children that prefer this to, say, baseball. which is a little disturbing, to be entirely honest. Think of individual sports in this country or even team sports where really the players are encouraged to scream and yell in joy when they've done well. In baseball, that will get you beaned.
Rachel, your story reminded me of a moment many years ago when my older daughter shouted from the backyard, "Hey, Daddy, come look what I can do." And she was hanging by her knees upside down from the top of the jungle gym. And I thought, okay, this is great. We got to put a mattress under the jungle gym now.
I might say that there's something to the idea that so many of our kids' activities now are, frankly, pre-safed. They're almost just not that much fun for them.
Yeah, and I think that's part of the appeal, right? I mean, kids love that there's a little bit of risk, and they even love that it's hard. You know, these kids I watched at this gym where they were trying some of these obstacles for 30, 40 minutes at a time and not getting them. And I think that's really amazing that they are so captivated they'll keep trying.
My guests for this week's Three Stories You Should Know have been Will Leach of Sports on Earth and Rachel Bachman of The Wall Street Journal. Thank you, both of you.
Thanks so much, Bill.
A pleasure as always.
This summer in Rio, Rich St. Simeon ran the 100 meters at the Olympic Games. It was the same race, though not the same heat, that reconfirmed Jamaican Usain Bolt as the fastest man in the world. Rich St. Simeon isn't even the fastest man on his community college track team. His resume consists of three track meets.
People I know, they're like, oh yeah, I'm faster than this guy, but it's all cool. Like, you know, I just you know, I'm just happy to get to do what I got to do.
Simeon was in Rio thanks to the Olympic Universality Rule. It's a sort of loophole that allows each participating country, in Simeon's case, the Marshall Islands, to send two track athletes and two swimmers to every summer games. They don't have to meet the qualifying times. So there's space in the Olympics for athletes from every country, but there's no space on the Marshall Islands to build a regulation track and field facility. Though Terry Sasser, Secretary General for the Marshall Islands Olympic Committee, says one is in the works anyway.
We don't have enough land, so we're going to have to do a reclamation to fill in some of the lagoon for half of the track and field.
The Marshall Islands, small and getting smaller as a result of climate change, only has a grass track now. And for the 2016 Games, Sasser and his colleagues had to look for an athlete who'd trained at something somewhere else.
We were putting the word out there, as we always are, just to kind of find athletes abroad. We have free travel back and forth from the U.S. And, you know, so a lot of the kids, you know, head to high school there or university. And so, you know, we've been tracking Rickson while he was a football player in Sacramento.
Simeon's parents are from the Marshall Islands. He grew up moving back and forth between there and the U.S., but Simeon wasn't discovered during one of those visits. That happened when he made a YouTube video of his best football moves.
I just posted on Facebook to share with family and friends.
I said, man, that guy's got some breakaway speed, you know, and a couple of our athletes were hurt and injured. We're like, wow, we might actually need this guy. So we went for it.
So the Marshall Islands contacted Simeon to ask if he'd like to spend the next 6 months training to run the 100 meters in Rio. Simeon wasn't sure how to respond. He was a year and a half past his final high school season.
I was like a little, like I was out of shape. And they were like, yeah, you know, your time, your football times was good and all that. And I was like, oh, yeah, about that.
No matter. The Marshall Islands Olympic Committee found a mentor for their aspiring sprinter. Rob Dewar is the head track coach at Sacramento Community College, just down the road from Simeon's home.
I didn't know how fast he was going to be. I really didn't. I wasn't expecting anything. I warned my athletes. I said, I have this young man coming out. He's new. And they're training for Olympic Games. So the kids are like, whoa, he's fast. I'm like, well, we'll see.
What Dewar and his team saw was an inexperienced runner with everything to learn. What Simeon saw was how far he had to go to catch up with the better runners on a community college team.
It was a humbling experience, but Richardson's a very humble person. And I just kept on telling him, I said, this is just day one, and just keep on coming back. You'll become faster, and you'll get better, but it's going to take some time. It's not going to happen overnight. We got through the first day. I thought to myself, if Rich can get through the first day, he can get through anything. And he did.
If that first day was hard, the first actual race in which Simeon competed was a lot harder.
That first race, he just got demolished. I don't know, mean so mean or anything, but he did. He forgot everything that we worked on through this whole time. Form and how to come out of blocks. And there's basically like 55 different things you have to go through for 100 meters. I kept it to like four things for him, but he forgot about them. Took him to the side, and he's like, whoa, that was just an experience I don't want to go through again.
And, like, I was kind of down for a while, and then, you know, I was thinking in my head, you know, I'm going against the guys in the top level in the world, like, to go race with them, it was going to be, like, a disaster.
Simeon didn't show up for practice the next day or the day after that, but eventually he came back, and when he did, he had a very simple goal.
You know, I try to work on my form, you know, just to look good. You know, at least, like, if I'm going to lose, you know, at least look good losing.
Terry Sasser and his committee on the Marshall Islands were supportive. Evidence of hard work and improvement were good enough for them. And so after about 6 months of training and a trip to the Micronesian Games, his second track meet ever, Simeon was off to Rio.
Once he got onto the plane, he texted me. He's like, I'm getting nervous. I'm like, that's good. There's nothing else I could do for him.
Marshall Islands in the Northern
Marshall
Pacific
Islands.
Ocean. Competing in just their third Olympic Games.
Simeon wore a traditional Marshallese skirt in the opening ceremonies, but when I asked him what he'd remember most, it wasn't the pomp and pageantry.
You know, when Usain Bolt was at the track, just Team Jamaica period, like, I was like a little bit nervous, you know, like, oh, these guys. I was in lane three, and Usain Bolt and them, they were in lane five or six. I was setting up the blocks, and I didn't get to set it up all the way. And, you know, it was like one, two, three, get off, and then, like, as soon as I went, the footing for the back foot, it goes flying off, and they're like, whoa. And, you know, I turn around, and I start laughing, and, you know, they're just looking at me like, man, you know, it was a good little funny moment we had.
It's a funny moment, but I wondered if you worried about whether they were thinking, what is this guy doing here? You can't even set the block.
I don't know. I talked to him a couple of times. They're cool. I forgot the name of the girl. Like, she has green hair. We're just sitting there talking, and seeing her on the big screen when we were at the track stadium, I was looking. I was like, wait, I talked to her like a couple of days ago, and, you know, it was kind of cool.
Also cool was the opportunity to join athletes from other island nations in a campaign against climate change.
Like, the climate change thing, it just came. Like, you know, everybody's talking about it. In some parts of the island, you see the effects of that. Some parts are, like, flooded, and, you know, it's like seawalls are being broken. Just to say something about it, like, you know, like, it felt good.
And then it was time to run.
And I'm just like, well, I'm about to run in the Olympics. And, you know, when I ran, it was just ready, set, go. And I just ran. And afterwards, it was like, wait, that was it? Just 10 seconds.
More like 11.81 seconds. It was a personal best for Simeon, but last place in his heat, tied for last in the entire event, and a full 2 seconds behind Usain Bolt's gold medal time. Coach Dewar did not make the trip to Rio, but he did see pictures of the race hours after it was over.
Because I was not up at 5:30 in the morning. Just being honest. Sorry about that, Richson. I saw his foot was turned the wrong way, and I was like, uh-oh. And that's just experience, because he's a rookie. And that's his nickname, I believe. And he's going to get better and better, but he goes by Rookie.
The rookie will get better. He's planning to continue training with Coach Dewar for the next 2 years. And if things go well, the Marshall Islands would like him to continue beyond that and set his sights on the Tokyo Games.
I know what to do to get faster now. If I do get another chance to go back to, like, the Olympics in 2020, I'm going to have, like, more experience and, like, a better time.
And I'm thinking the Jamaican runner with the green hair might be there, too. I don't know if that was exactly a preview for the next Summer Games, but maybe we have given you an early rooting interest in that spectacle. I'll start with a hike, because we're a sports program, and hiking, sports, whatever. Maybe I'll end with a hike, too. Also, I was wearing a baseball cap. It wasn't much of a hike, and what there was, we could have avoided. If you want to, you can get off the boat and get right on a bus and be at the Glacial Lake in a few minutes. We hiked. Walked, really. It takes maybe 15 minutes. Off to the left of the brown dirt road, you see a forest and lots of shades of green, and at one point off to the right, you see a sign that says, Kiss a Moose. Turn at the sign and walk down a little path, and having paid a handful of Norwegian kroner, you can get close enough to a penned-up, tired-looking moose to kiss it, if that's what you want to do. Or you can keep walking up the hill toward the lake, and when you get there a few minutes later, you can have a cup of coffee and a Norwegian cookie, and you can look across the water, which is impossibly clear, at the Svartisen Glacier. Between the tip of the glacier and the shore of the lake, you'll see about 20 yards of wet rock. The Svartisen is Norway's second largest glacier, and it used to be larger. I know that because I asked the guide. Actually, first I asked him if he spoke English. Didn't you hear me on the bus? He asked. I walked, I said. Hiked. He shrugged. So, I asked him, is this glacier receding? 16 years ago it reached the lake, he said. Now it falls 20 yards short. 16 years ago it didn't. Not 600 years ago. Not 60 years ago. 16. Look it up, and you'll learn that the Svartisen Glacier still covers about 230 square miles over several municipalities in northern Norway. People used to casually hike not just to it, but on it. That's not allowed these days. Just to get close to the glacier, you have to have a guide, and you have to cross something called the danger zone. Still, it is no slouch, this glacier. At some points, it's hundreds of meters thick. The guide who told me about the glacier isn't a scientist, and neither am I. I'm just a guy who had the good fortune to visit Norway recently, and I'm bringing back the news. 16 years ago, people like me, visiting that country's second largest glacier, eating a cookie and sipping coffee, would see the ice meet the lake. Now it's not like that, which is something to think about when you hike down the dirt road from the lake back to the boat. We'll be right back with Charlie Pierce and more sports, NPR style, next week on Only a Game. A stateless boxer in the Dominican Republic fights for the rights of Haitian immigrants.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Next week on Only a Game, a stateless boxer in the Dominican Republic fights for the rights of Haitian immigrants. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
Since we last spoke, the man who taught an awful lot of people to care about golf has passed away. Do you have a remembrance of Arnold Palmer that you'd like to share?
Well, I was never in the same room with him, as far as I know. But I do remember him as being one of the very first people who played a sport whom I remember first from watching on television, because he was on every week. He brought golf down to at least the white middle class. Mm. Mm. And let's be completely accurate about this. There are few figures in any sport in this country who loom as large in the history of their sport than Arnold Palmer.
You wrote an article a while back about Tiger Woods, really when Tiger Woods was first beginning his career, in which you said the great thing about Tiger Woods was he tried to win every tournament. He wasn't going for the top three or the top ten. The same could certainly be said of Arnold Palmer.
There's a difference between athletes who like to win and athletes who like to beat people. And I think he was a little bit of both. I mean, there's a great story in George Plimpton's book about his life on the 1 year of the PGA Tour called The Bogeyman, in which some drunk guy in a bar keeps badgering Arnold Palmer to play him in a $10 Nassau the next day. And finally, Palmer gets fed up and says, fine, I'll play you tomorrow. We start at 7 o'clock and we're playing a $5,000 Nassau, not a $10 Nassau. And the guy just sort of melts away into the crowd.
The Chicago Cubs locked up the best league record last weekend. I don't know how they're going to do in the postseason, but the team apparently felt strongly enough about what a good job GM Theo Epstein had done. They have given him a very lucrative contract extension.
5 years, $18.5 million, and he's been worth every dime.
It should be noted, by the way, that Theo Epstein hasn't done that good a job. The Cubs could only manage a tie against the Pirates. Wait a minute, a tie?
A one-to-one tie.
There's no ties in baseball.
There is, actually. There is a tie in baseball. It was raining very hard in Pittsburgh. They had to quit in the sixth inning. The game means nothing. So the Cubs, on Friday morning, stood at 101-57-1.
Like a really good soccer team.
Exactly.
I don't know how long Buffalo Bills head coach Rex Ryan will be in the National Football League, but I think he might have a career waiting for him after he retires. How do you like the sound of Rex Ryan, private investigator?
Well, he got on the weekly conference call that every team has to have with the press and the team they're playing the following week. And first of all, he claimed to be Walt Podolsky, who's an old football player,
by the way. I knew the name.
He was Walt Podolsky from the Buffalo News, and he asked New England's Julian Edelman if he was playing quarterback this week. And actually, he did it in front of his home press corps, and Rex got an answer, which was a very patriot answer. I'm going to do whatever the coaches ask me to do, Edelman said. See what we go through here, Rex? Seriously.
Would you agree with me that Tim Duncan has found a really good way to ease his way into retirement?
Yeah, Popovich has said that he can be the coach of whatever he feels like. If I'm Tim Duncan, I make myself the coach of sitting in a lounge chair back home in the Virgin Islands and taking the occasional phone call from the front office.
I was going to say, it's like, I want to be the coach of ice cream.
Exactly.
It's like being the emperor of ice cream. Yankees fan Andrew Fox had it all planned on Tuesday night. He would propose to Heather Terwilliger at Yankee Stadium. But is it fair to say that an error nearly ruined his season and the season of his would-be fiancée as well?
He dropped the ring.
Oh.
And it's anyone who's ever dropped anything in a baseball stadium knows it can float away on a river of stale beer. I mean, all sorts of bad things that could happen. But a search went on and actually became part of the drama of the game until they finally found it.
Formula One drivers are apparently accustomed to wildlife wandering onto F1 tracks around the world. I didn't know this, and the whole idea scares me. But drivers in last weekend's race in Singapore were stunned at what ambled out onto the track. What was it?
First of all, let's run down the history of animals in Formula One racing. There are groundhogs and foxes in Canada, stray dogs in New Delhi, India. There have been snakes in Malaysia and a cat in the first race in Azerbaijan. And this time, as one of the drivers, a guy named Max Verstappen, announced on his radio, there's a giant lizard on the track. This was a monitor lizard. These things are serious animals.
Yeah.
And if one happens to cross your track while you're driving, stay in the car.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce in Sports Illustrated. And he joins me each week on Only a Game as well. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Commentator Mike Pesca has been thinking about the death last weekend of one of Major League Baseball's most promising and charismatic young stars.
The death of Miami Marlins pitcher Jose Fernandez is a tragedy, both human and athletic, but also aesthetic. Fernandez played the game with joy and ease, you might say a comportment belying his stuff, which was a fastball that could touch 100, a curve that paired with that fastball was unfair, and a slider, slightly different from his curve, that was probably the best in baseball's after Clayton Kershaw's. But he didn't need the slider that much, because did I mention the curve and the fastball? Of course, you could also argue that his ability, his dominance, didn't belie his comportment. It enabled it. After all, if you're going to be as gleeful and sometimes goofy between the chalk, you have to back it up with impeccable stuff. But I think of the Fernandez ability versus personality dynamic a little bit differently. I think for too long in sports, but especially baseball, we've been sold this bill of goods on what it means to be a competitor. A professional, someone who plays the game the right way. Players, especially Latin players, are often punished for showing joy. There is the enforced code of the ball in the ear for a bat flip or the purpose pitch in retaliation for a perceived slight. It doesn't have to be this way. In the Japanese leagues, a pitcher will tip his cap after hitting an opposing batter, and no one assumes that pitcher is soft or that he's given up the advantage of intimidation. Randy Johnson was said to be an intimidating player because he glowered from the mound and he had a release point that seemed to extend to within 15 feet of home plate. And oh yeah, that thing he was releasing, the ball was dancing and moving in the upper 90s. But in actuality, it wasn't how Randy Johnson acted that was intimidating. It was his pitches. The stare and the frown and the darkness, they were just trappings. Had Randy Johnson or Bob Gibson or Steve Carlton ever doffed his cap or wished you a good day, sir, after a punch out, they would have been the same dominant pitchers they were. And I could also name hundreds of sourpuss southpaws and huffy hurlers who are bad pitchers, too. They glowered. They just couldn't get anyone out. Spitting nails doesn't make a pitcher good. Throwing darts does. I think the single thing enforcing baseball's unwritten rules of gloom, intimidation, and umbrage taking is that players, mostly American players, have been habituated to that mindset. And too often they've been told they can't behave otherwise. But I hope that some young players not yet infected with the idea that the only way to play is the angry way to play, take the lesson of Jose Fernandez. So talented, more likely to induce a strikeout than any player in baseball, and more likely to feel good about doing it and show that he feels good. And during those rare times that he didn't, more likely to look forward to the next opportunity.
Mike Pesca hosts the daily podcast The Gist from Slate. He's a panelist on the sports podcast Hang Up and Listen, which posts every Monday. As a young grad student, Rachel Terrell decided to study love and relationships in the NFL. She came to this research with little in the way of background except for one thing. She had fallen in love with a man who would become an NFL player. And on the way to her doctorate, Rachel Terrell discovered that almost everything she knew about NFL players and the women who loved them was wrong. She tells us her story in her own words.
We were in a group project together at Purdue University. I wasn't a big fan of football. I liked basketball, but more importantly, I liked academics. I made myself the group leader and assigned him to do the introduction and conclusion because I was afraid he might mess it up because that's what a dumb jock would do. And he was quiet enough and kind enough to just say, okay. The first time I really talked with Craig was after class. He walked out with me and I saw a guitar sitting in the back of his car. And so I asked him that night if he would sing something to me. And he did. He sang Peaceful, Easy Feeling by the Eagles. It made me want to hear more. I realized that there was a lot more to him than just being a jock. He was quiet, but he was very intelligent. After I graduated, I went down to grad school in Florida. One of my classmates said, "Are you going to go watch the Purdue football game?" So I sent him an email asking if he was going to be in town. He replied, "Yes, can we get together for dinner?" And we went into downtown Celebration where soap fell from the sky and was meant to look like snow falling. And that was the night that I fell madly in love. I flew up to his family farm in Indiana for draft day. His mom invited over 40 or 50 of their closest friends and family members. There was a cake congratulating him, but we didn't know whether or not he'd be an NFL player after that. As the sixth round began, the phone started to ring. And as they called, I thought, oh, just say no, don't draft him, because then maybe he can be drafted by a Florida team. And so the first few teams that called didn't draft him. And then the phone rang again, and it was Seattle. And he talked to them for just a couple minutes before his eyes started to tear up, and he pointed to the television. And so we got our cameras ready, and there was his name. In the sixth round, Seattle Seahawks picked Craig Terrell. I was scared and sad and worried, because Seattle was all the way across the country. I didn't know anything about the NFL other than what I saw on television or what I read about in the news, and none of that was good. And it was scary, but because I was so crazy in love with him, I was also extremely excited for his dream. My dream was to be a professor. I wanted to teach. I wanted to write. That was my dream, and my dream was happening in grad school in Florida. He gave me a big hug and said, I believe in your dream and I believe in you, and it'll all work out, I promise. Realizing that we couldn't go back and forth easily, I asked my advisor what he would think about me studying love in the NFL in the field. Perhaps more realistic than me, my advisor said, I think you'll regret it if you go, but I can't stop you. The first time I was invited to an event with other NFL wives, it was to a team-wide baby shower. I looked in my closet, and I had my college t-shirts and jeans. My nails weren't manicured, and my hair wasn't stylish. And so, paralyzed by that fear, I sat in our small, dark apartment during that baby shower and for many weekends that followed. I felt lonely. And I felt alone. Craig was working full-time to keep his roster spot on the team. And I wished that I had a network there, but I didn't feel like that would be other NFL wives. I thought that I would go and just couple by couple move my way through and say, I'm doing an academic report. Can you please tell me everything about your life? And I soon realized that NFL couples are very guarded. Eventually, Craig made a close friend on the team. He had been in the league for several years, and his wife then was an established NFL wife. And then she took me one by one to other NFL wives on the team and said, this is Rachel. I want you to meet her. You can trust her. Tell her the truth. Other wives started seeking me out, and they said, there's no one else who understands. I can't tell my friends at home because they say, why do you feel alone? Why do you feel lonely? Why do you feel scared? You can't have problems or issues because your husband makes an X amount on his paycheck. And I can't talk to my husband because he's playing and he's worried about making the team. Can I talk to you and tell you my story? It felt wonderful. I kept seeing bits and pieces of myself in them. And I was shocked. And at first I thought that I must be meeting the anomalies because they were educated and they were intelligent. And they had drive and they had dreams. They were a lot like me. It was never my dream to marry somebody in the NFL, but it was a life that I very much loved and enjoyed. When Craig was cut for the first time, I was no longer an NFL wife. I had Bible studies that I was getting ready to host. I had a luncheon the next day. When you're not an NFL wife anymore, you're no longer invited to the NFL wife luncheon. And if you're not an NFL wife anymore, there's no reason for you to host the NFL wife Bible study. And so it was just a tremendously hard time for both of us. 7 weeks later, Craig was re-signed by the Seahawks. And so we had one more season. It was kind of a snap back into reality. What should have been a 5-year degree at the beginning was nearing year 8. And I had only a year before they would say, you may no longer finish. This degree has taken you too long. It was Craig who reminded me, you want to be a professor. You want to be a writer. You want to teach. you need to do this. And so during that time, I got serious about finishing my dissertation because we remembered and realized that the NFL really would end. And when it did, we would need something else. So on his time off and after the season, Craig and I almost completely shifted roles. He became a full-time, hands-on parent, and he did the cooking and the cleaning and everything that needed to be done around the house so that I could do nothing but write. And then after our little one was in bed, he would read through, and he was also my editor on all the first drafts. I finished. Craig's career had just ended, and in fact, I walked across the stage at graduation with Craig in the audience holding our then two children. If I was talking to somebody else who was several months into a relationship with somebody when they were drafted in the NFL, would I say, go take a chance? Heck no. It's not the smart path to take to follow anybody across the country to live their dream with them and to put your own dreams on hold. Craig is amazing, but the odds certainly weren't in my favor.
That's Dr. Rachel Terrell. She teaches at Purdue and Northwest University, and her husband, Craig Terrell, is now a full-time dad and musician. Our story was produced by Karen Given. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Martin Kessler. We had help this week from Alex Schroeder. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our intern is Jeremy Relosa, and our senior producer is Gary Wallach. Our final word comes from Tim Kirchen, who muses on a World Series featuring the Chicago Cubs and the Boston Red Sox.
That is going to happen. It is the dream matchup, and I honestly think they're the two best teams.
Ah, come on, Tim. You jinxed it. I know how bad your predictions are. These two teams could have met in the World Series, and now you think? Nah. I'm Bill Littlefield. We return next week with more sports NPR style and Only a Game. Thanks for listening.
Support for Only a Game comes from WBUR Boston. Jane and Gerald Katcher, supporting the Children's Movement of Florida, dedicated to helping all children enter school with the social, emotional, and intellectual skills needed to succeed. More information is available at childrensmovementflorida.org. And Emily and Antoine Van Uchtmail, supporting New Futures, which works to help low-income D.C. area youth graduate from community college or certificate programs and become financially self-sufficient. Information is available at newfuturesdc.org.